One phase of medical screening which has received considerable attention because of its cost-saving potential is the use of computers to obtain medical histories directly from the patient without need for presence of a doctor. We think you'll be interested in the experiences of Dr. Warner Slack, now at Beth Israel Hospital in Boston. He developed such techniques at the University of Wisconsin.
I would like to talk very briefly about some of the work that we have been doing at the University of Wisconsin and more recently in Boston with the use of a computer as an interactive device for collecting medical history information from patients. In the early days of computer medicine, there was a lot of emphasis on the trickiness of the diagnostic decision-making process, and people were interested in computer diagnosis and using all sorts of mathematical techniques and arriving at diagnostic decision-making algorithms, things of this order, which are interesting and have great potential, I think. On the other hand, the real bottleneck in clinical medicine is not the diagnostic decision-making process nearly so much as it is the data collection process. If a physician is presented with a cogent statement of the medical background of a patient, he may be able to put this together diagnostically very quickly, in a matter of seconds or minutes. But asking 300 or 400 questions of a patient in the process is a very time-consuming situation. And now, it was with this in mind that we decided to tackle the problem of the medical history. And there had been work done with self-administered questionnaires, and these the self-administered were the patient administering this to himself, checking in the yes or no box depending upon his answer. Cornell Medical Index is the first example of this. A powerful device and being used well today. And self-administered questionnaires overcome such problems as the long time it takes a doctor to ask questions and the expense of physician-patient interaction. Talk is not cheap in medicine. It's perhaps the most expensive commodity in the clinical process. And if you examine psychiatry, where talk is, at least in many instances, the only commodity, and the going rates are in the range of $40, $50 an hour, you get some idea as to the full how expensive professional talk is when the client is paying for this. And the self-administered questionnaire is an economical device to administer. And of course, very important is the fact that it's standardized. The responses are in a known location available for quick retrieval and use, both in patient care and clinical research. But it was our thought that perhaps by interfacing a patient with a computer, we might be able to model some of the advantages that the physician or the human interviewer has going for him, namely the ability to qualify items in detail, to branch, to adapt one's history, to individualize it to the particular needs of the patient. And then we might also be able to utilize some of the psychological controls that a physician utilizes. When a patient doesn't understand, the physician can explain. We might be able to incorporate that into the system, to use words of encouragement en route through the process, to make satisfactory completion of a potentially very detailed history more likely with the use of reinforcement techniques. It was with these thoughts in mind that we programmed a very small computer, the laboratory instrument computer, a standalone device that we had available to us back in 1964 with a small cathode ray tube on this, on the console. We programmed this to interview patients with regard to their allergy symptoms. At the time that we first started this work, the small standalone computer was the only thing available to us. We were advised to wait for the Burroughs 8500 terminals. I'm still waiting. And we had a few political hassles in conjunction with that in Madison, but we were able to get our own small machine and press on with our research. And it turned out to be a very nice device for testing the computer as a medical history collector. And more recently, we have in Madison programmed a small computer. Now it would be a PDP-12, which is connected by a buffer display system to three standard television CRTs, and computer-based patient interviewing is in routine use now at the University of Wisconsin hospitals, both in the outpatient clinic and on a general medical ward. If the patient did not understand or didn't know the answer, we would branch out, explain to him the meaning, reword the question, come back, make comprehension more likely. And we began to incorporate computer instruction techniques into the system. When a patient didn't understand the meaning, we would actually teach him using computer-based instruction. We've also incorporated a fifth response for the patient, to overcome the assumption the patient is in fact willing to answer. We start out with it as none of your damn business. We've now toned it down to skip it. And it's not used very often, but it's obvious that its presence is appreciated. I say that on the basis of the gusto with which people press it when they do in fact use it. As a matter of fact, I don't think that people should be forced to answer any question they don't want to. In medicine and almost all types of interviewing, we just assume that the client should answer, and if he balks or something, we use circuitous methods, devious tricks to try and get information from him. After all, it is his information, it's his life, it's his health status, and I think we should work very hard to make it clear to the patient why, in fact, we're asking the question. And I must say as an aside that well over 50% of the questions in our medical history, and I think most medical histories, are of moot value. We don't really know the meaning of the medical history as it's traditionally taken. But insofar as we do know why we're asking the questions, we ought to explain this to the patient and then let him decide whether or not he cares to answer. And we've begun to do this. If a patient says skip it with regard to a question, we'll now explain. We're asking this because sometimes it may be of help to you and think, do you still want to skip it? And if he says yes, fine. From the habits section of our general medical history, have you ever smoked tobacco? If no, a little positive reinforcement, good for you. Cigarettes in particular can be bad for your health. Please press go to continue. If he is a smoker, now we have a little instructional system in there which tells him about some of the dangers he may be subjecting himself to in conjunction with a tobacco habit, and some of the data and things of that order, with the hope of discouraging him, but once again, obviously, it's his decision. Then on to a fairly detailed history of tobacco consumption, and then finally out to the next habits question, which has to do with alcohol. And perhaps due to the biases of the writer, namely myself, the computer is a good bit more gentle on the drinker than it is on the smoker.
It's clear that doctors such as Warner Slack have learned how to capture the essence of bedside manner on a computer tape. Now we'd like to move from these fairly general topics to a specific example of modern engineering application in a medical facility. Dr. Paul H. Griffith of the Varian Corporation, working with his associates and with staff at the Harbor General Hospital in the San Francisco Bay Area, has coupled a mini-computer and special electronic interface equipment to medical test equipment to arrive at a facility which speeds testing in areas related to operation of the human pulmonary system, that is, the lungs.
I'd like to describe a computer system which was designed to solve certain problems associated with two separate laboratories, an exercise physiology laboratory and a pulmonary function testing laboratory. These laboratories are located at Harbor General Hospital, and they are directed by Dr. Carlman Wasserman, who collaborated throughout the development of this system. I feel the application is typical of increasing use of mini computers in diagnostic medicine, a use which is expected to accelerate during the 70s. The first laboratory, that is the exercise physiology laboratory, conducts investigations of respiratory physiology. It's a laboratory which is strongly research-oriented. It also carries out occasional clinical evaluation of patients by placing them under exercise stress. In these tests, the quantities which are of most physiological interest are ventilation rate, oxygen uptake, carbon dioxide production, and the gas exchange ratio, among others. Direct, or that is manual, measurements which are available in the laboratory require tedious calculations and are slow, so they can reveal little about the very important topic of transient behavior. The goal for the computer was to bring about a significant improvement in computational capability by making online calculations for each breath. The emphasis is on graphical presentation using existing oscillographic recorders. The second laboratory, that is the pulmonary function testing laboratory, routinely performs tests whose results are used by pulmonary disease specialists for diagnosis. Here the goal for the computer was to reduce the time required for testing the patient and preparing the associated report. And accuracy improvement was also anticipated because of the elimination of manual handling of data. We designed the system with certain constraints in mind. It must be used by technicians who are not skilled in computer programming, but they are, however, thoroughly familiar with the manual techniques which were in use before installation of the system. We also wanted to allow as much freedom as possible to execute certain steps of the procedure in any desired order, and we wanted to provide for visual verification of results. We feel that with computer systems in general, and this one is no exception, it is important to avoid trapping the operator in a position where he could not exit from an unsuccessful procedure. And, of course, the laboratories must not interact with each other. The two laboratories timeshare the computer. We wouldn't want things to come to a halt in one laboratory because of some improper procedure followed by the technician in another laboratory. The exercise laboratory installation, the first laboratory, the computer system becomes an added link in an analog data stream, with its service being to provide calculations, data storage, and augmented graphical display.
Figure 2 in your pamphlet shows a schematic of the overall system. Photographs of these facilities are also included in the pamphlet.
The flow of data starts at the transducers. The patient sits on the bicycle ergometer seat and breathes through a mouthpiece. It then progresses to the signal conditioning inputs of the oscillographic recorder, and the signals are plotted in the chart paper. The auxiliary output of each recorder channel provides an input to the computer. The computer results can be recorded on digital magnetic tape and at the same time played back to unused channels of the oscillographic recorder. After the study, selected records on the magnetic tape can be output to the recorder as desired, and a permanent record of the study can be printed on the teletypewriter. In the pulmonary function laboratory, the computer does data recording, calculation, and report preparation, which was done manually before. We're not doing anything new here scientifically. We're simply implementing some of the things that are tedious and repetitive. In the other laboratory, we have essentially a new tool. Here in this laboratory, we wanted to perturb the existing diagnostic procedures as little as possible, and so we kept the sequence of events in performing a patient evaluation about the same as that which prevailed before installation of the data system. We have tried to achieve maximal quantitative agreement between manual test results and results calculated by the data system, because physicians have established an intuitive feel for normal and abnormal magnitudes in this area of medicine, which we must not invalidate. The laboratory methodology and the instruments used are largely the same as before the introduction of the data system in both laboratories. The spirometers, which were originally used for measurement of volume, have been replaced by a flow transducer, which is a pneumotachograph. Its signal is integrated within the computer to obtain volumes. Rapidly responding sensors are required because intra-breath wave shapes must be reproduced. Carbon dioxide, nitrogen, and oxygen are measured with gas analyzers, which have transient rise times on the order of 100 milliseconds. The heart rate signal is derived from electrocardiographic electrodes and is updated immediately after each beat. The signal from each gas analyzer is also delayed by a gas transport time, which is distinct from the rise time. We compensate for the transport time by storing arriving data until the data has arrived from the transducer with the longest delay. The oscillographic recorders used are typical of those found in medical laboratories. They have 4 to 8 channels, generally, and our direct writing with capillary ink flow. Plug-in signal conditioning amplifiers take care of furnishing some noise filtering. The computer is a 16-bit, 12,000-word Varian 620i mini computer, And 8 channels of analog data are acquired via a multiplexed analog-to-digital converter. There are 10 digital-to-analog converters which generate voltages for plotting on the recorders. A 9-track, industry-compatible digital magnetic tape unit records the quantities computed in the exercise laboratory, that is, the first laboratory. Each laboratory has a teleprinter with a paper tape facility on which we print or punch permanent output records. The exercise laboratory has a push-button console, which the operator uses to control the program. There is a numeric keyboard here for entry of data. Messages are given to the operator by illuminating labels on the console. The pulmonary laboratory has a console with an alphanumeric CRT terminal and push buttons arranged around the screen such that they may be labeled by words displayed on the screen. The button is illuminated to indicate to the operator that the designers of the program recommend that he push that button next. The technicians communicate with the computer programs entirely through the consoles. The computer program is structured on a 20 millisecond time cycle basis. The primary event in each cycle is sampling of the input data. The execution time per cycle is never allowed to exceed the established cycle length. About 60% of each cycle is surplus computing time, except during demand peaks, so that a more sophisticated time-sharing monitor would allow an additional laboratory to use the computer. In both laboratories, the operators determine which of several well-defined data analysis tasks will be performed by using the consoles. After a task is initiated, the software takes care of all the data storage and retrieval and the tape manipulation, performs the requested calculations, generates graphical output, and generates printed reports. It is common practice in the laboratories to calibrate the sensors every day, or even oftener. A computer program is provided to automatically acquire calibration data and to calculate the proper conversion factors for expressing the output in practical, or that is, real-world units. Also, the computer outputs standard voltages to allow the user to adjust the span and the baseline of the recorders. Next, we'll see a typical analog recording.
The record referred to is shown as figure 3. Each major cycle is one breath.
This is what we would see on the chart recorder. This is the raw data coming from the transducers. Now, the chart paper was run faster in the center to allow observation of the details of the curves. The time scale is indicated by 1-second markers along the top. The flow signal, the airflow, is the next curve. The next one is carbon dioxide partial pressure, then oxygen partial pressure, and then heart rate. And then in the center, instead of heart rate, we have the actual electrocardiogram. The bottom curve is the computed oxygen uptake, computed on a breath-by-breath basis, and each transition here is taking place at the end of one breath. Computations are held, the value is held for the next breath. Studies like this frequently go on for many yards of chart paper. Manual breath-by-breath data reduction just isn't feasible, and so a computer must be used to obtain a picture of how the quantities vary with time. The slide.
Figure 4 is a redrawn form of Figure 3, showing the various key points on the charts.
Shows schematic representation of the signals that are measured, the input signals to the computer in the exercise laboratory. Airflow is derived from the expired line, and consequently we see no signal part of the time. This is the inspiration period here, as you can see from this notation. Carbon dioxide and oxygen partial pressures, here's carbon dioxide and here's oxygen, are sampled at the mouthpiece, and so that both inspired and expired phases are seen. A breath is taken to extend from the beginning of its inspiration here to the end of its expiration here. These points are sensed by determining when the flow signal, the top tracing, passes a threshold. The threshold is the dotted line. And we see that here the signal has risen above the threshold. At this point, we would say the flow is taking place. The flow baseline is sensed during inspiration, each breath, and corrections are made for transducer drift. The breath volume is derived by integration of the flow signal. The gas concentrations are multiplied by the flow at each sample point, and the result is integrated to give oxygen uptake and carbon dioxide production for each breath. Now, the maxima and minima of the partial pressure curves are observed by the program to calculate end tidal, or that is, end of breath values, and especially the minimum is used to check for baseline drift and make correction. The heart rate is also sensed and averaged over each breath. Certain steps are taken to correct artifacts before the data is output. Up to 8 of the calculated quantities can be selected and plotted. In this particular laboratory, the recorder has 8 pins. The plotback speed is limited only by the response time of the recorder pins, and in practice it can be 10 times the original data acquisition rate. The chart speed can be adjusted so that when the whole study is plotted, it can all be viewed easily without scanning from one sheet of paper to another. The computer also makes event marks in response to a foot switch. These are stored also on the digital tape to let us determine where work was begun or other events took place. With such a presentation as this, transient phenomena are readily observed, even though breathing is typically subject to considerable random fluctuation. In fact, these variations can lead to serious errors if air samples are taken blindly or randomly for later analysis by collection in a bag, for example. Now again, we'll go to the pulmonary laboratory. The single breathing apparatus is used for all tests, the gas sensors and flow sensors are located in the mouthpiece and tubing of this breathing apparatus. Sensor baselines are again sensed and corrected automatically at the appropriate times during each breath. 7 tests are performed in the laboratory. Typically, the technician begins by positioning the patient so that he breathes through the breathing apparatus, and then he instructs him in the breathing maneuvers to be performed. The technician then presses a button to select the test to be performed, and he does his selection from a list displayed on the screen. The exact sequence of the test is then determined both by events detected in the data by the program and by the operator's use of other buttons. Data output from the system takes several forms. During a test, certain analog quantities, such as the spirogram, which is a plot of lung volume versus time, are plotted on the recorder. At the conclusion of each test, results of that test are displayed immediately on the console screen, along with all the previous results for that particular test. The tests are often repeated to obtain the best result. After the operator selects the best result, this same screen displays the accumulated results for all of the tests completed for this patient. When a patient study has been completed, the operator initiates the printing of the patient report. The report displays and labels the results of each test and also shows the predicted values, which are computed by means of standard formulas. This is done by use of patient data such as height and weight, and this has been entered by the operator via the console keyboard. Concurrently, a paper tape record of just the results is punched. This computer application, I believe, is typical of an important future use of many computers in medicine, namely online data acquisition as distinguished from later batch processing of data. And this acquisition and processing is used to speed patient examination and improve diagnostic inference.
Clearly, this is only one example out of hundreds of related applications of engineering to medicine. One important point was emphasized, echoing Dr. Lamson's earlier warning. Automation fits in best where the basic medical techniques used are those with which the doctors are already familiar. Naturally, this means that revolutionary changes come but slowly. But the nature of the medical business, the handling of human lives, would make an engineering failure a medical catastrophe. And as Dr. Lamson pointed out, you might imagine yourself the patient. To conclude our brief examination of engineering in the health industry, we've invited Dr. Julia Apter of Presbyterian St. Luke's Hospital in Chicago to join us for an interview. Julia is a remarkable woman, an MD, surgeon, PhD, biologist, and a very active member of IEEE. Furthermore, she's a woman's activist. She's chic, persuasive, and just a bundle of energy. She's highly dedicated to the concept of engineers in the health industry, especially in the hospitals. Julia, would you give us an example of engineering applied in hospitals out of your own experiences?
I'd like to describe one group of medical engineers at a very fine Eastern hospital. These medical engineers wait for the doctor to come to them for help. They are composed primarily of people who are expert circuit designers, and all of them who have not yet reached the Master of Science level are still going to school, even though they work full-time for the hospital. They sit on safety committees for the hospital and for research groups. They judge the safety of purchases. They repair existing medical equipment. Repair needs are called to their attention at the safety conferences. They assess the quality and function of purchased equipment, and they also consult concerning the building and the rebuilding of portions of the hospital. They're responsible for routine functional checks of the equipment. It's their job to make sure that they have checked on each piece of equipment that they think might possibly go wrong, and they calibrate whenever it is certainly called to their attention and have a routine for recurrent calibration. They are cooperating in the development of new medical technical equipment for special assigned purposes. While I was there, they were developing new kinds of thermistors and new ways of using thermistors for checking cardiac output in living human subjects. And of course, they were responsible for non-hazardous effects of the medical equipment, both for patients and for the personnel who operate. This is a 1,000-bed hospital, and they have 30 people in their medical engineering group.
What would be the typical number of doctors involved in a hospital of a particular size?
Actually, if it's a 1,000-bed hospital, you would expect at least about 1,000 doctors if they do research, too. It's only in urban areas that you would find this much research going on. Throughout the country, however, there could easily be 100 doctors attached to a 100-bed hospital as attending physicians. Now, this particular group of medical engineers did a very big and important service for the hospital. They updated the doctor's paging system. It was redundant, inaccurate, untestable, required the use of personnel in its operation that were expensive and not really functioning very well. Not only did they update the system, but they now service it, and it is one of the biggest sources of revenue for the medical engineering group. They also consult with doctors on clinical and developmental and research projects. They have a myocardial infarction research unit, one of the kinds of heart attacks. They are also custom making a computerized monitoring system that is patterned after the MedLab system developed in Salt Lake City in Utah. Naturally, on the intensive therapy unit, they are constantly evaluating the equipment, making, checking it for reliability of the signals, helping to train nurses and other personnel in the use of the equipment. Considering the work that this particular group is doing for this Eastern Hospital, it is therefore not surprising to hear a lieutenant colonel in the Surgeon General's office state that for the 117,000 beds in military hospitals, he would expect to need at least one engineer for every 200 of those beds. That amounts to about 5,000 people called medical engineers in the sense that we have just described. And I certainly would not want to speak for him, but he has said this in public, and I feel we should pursue that particular possible use for our engineers, but also to use it as an example we could present to other hospitals as possible ways to hire our engineers.
You mentioned the matter of safety in the hospitals. No doubt the consequences to the patient and the hospital as well could be very serious.
It can be a serious economic problem to a hospital because the person who gets burned from inadequate, improper equipment will justifiably be suing the hospital. And this may turn out to be an even more expensive problem for the hospitals when the medical device legislation is actually enforced. Standards will be much higher than are presently applicable, and we would certainly recommend that there be a standards expert in every hospital that would be consulted in the purchase and operation of equipment.
I've seen many varieties of medical instruments, each with its own size and shape and voltage outputs and control positions. There doesn't seem to be very much industry-wide standardization in the medical electronics industry.
I am not aware of seeing any improvement going on. I do know that certain safety standards are most definitely being developed. The Federal Register of May 1971 has such standards outlined and specifies where these standards will be coming from and that they are indeed currently in law, although not altogether being enforced.
I would hope that as medical systems build into complex interconnected arrays of electronics and computers and so on, that systems coordination would receive a very high priority with the doctors and the engineers as well. For example, nuclear physicists around the world have systematized their instrumentation, and this is gaining wide acceptance. Is the health industry at that stage of development yet?
There does seem to be little coordination in the industry, and I have heard people in industry blame the physicians for this, that the physicians have not been able to articulate what their needs are. Now, this is one place that I feel the person who is both an engineer and a doctor can be helpful because such a person seems to be better able to articulate the defects in the knowledge of a doctor.
How many of these engineer physicians do you personally know of that are in the field at the present time?
About 25. This might be about one-tenth of the number. There was a time when many engineers decided to go to medical school because they became dissatisfied with engineering. The engineers who became doctors, by and large, have become academic personnel, although many of them are in private practice as physicians and love it and are very good doctors.
In the education of our doctors, are there opportunities for them to gain the knowledge of electronics or computers, which they'll certainly need for effective use of those technologies?
At our particular school, he will not have a course in the use of computers as a required course, but there will be a course that's elective. And at the University of Illinois, too, there are electives.
I can understand that an engineer who's also a physician has a substantial advantage in dealing with other physicians. I've heard many engineers, especially those involved with busy practicing physicians, comment that the doctors treated them as if they were merely technicians. Would you like to comment on this rather touchy subject?
In two hospitals that I'm fully acquainted with, the engineers are self-supporting, self-reliant, full-time consultants. Degrees that are represented are PhDs, master's degrees in electrical engineering, bachelor's degrees in electrical engineering, bachelor's degrees in other sciences, but doing engineering kind of work, and then the associate's degrees. But when they have not yet reached at least a master's level, they are expected to continue to go to school even though they are working full-time for the hospital or the medical care center. They did have to recognize and accept the fact that the doctors were, let us say, prima donnas at first. However, when the doctors found that they could rely on the engineers and that they wanted to rely on the engineers, they became very much more pleasant to work with, and the rapport between the two groups was obviously very good. But I do know that there have been times when the engineers have sometimes said, well, I'm too good to be simply a technician for you. They would have an idea in their own mind of what constituted a technician and felt that the work that the doctor was asking for or would accept was technician's work. Let us say that this was technician's work to begin with. An engineer who accepts that role will be getting his foot in the door, helping the doctor to adjust to his way of thinking and to the kinds of services he can perform. And he ends up soon helping with his research, helping develop new methods.
I would imagine the doctor himself, especially during his internship, may have some of the same feelings.
The doctor does have to go through quite a bit of being subjected to certain kinds of chores that he would rather not have to go through, even during the time that he's a doctor, but certainly on his way to becoming a full-fledged practicing physician.
I've heard a doctor, who shall here be nameless, refer to his MD as the best union card there is. Certainly the gap between physicians' incomes in the U.S. and that of our engineers is a substantial one. As we chatted before the interview, you made it clear that you felt that more self-discipline is needed among doctors. Would you care to comment for the record?
Both engineers and doctors will have to start thinking primarily of the well-being of the patient, a more altruistic attitude on both their parts in order for them to get along better.
Julia, basically, why are you so personally interested in the increased involvement of engineers in the health field?
Anybody like a doctor who must be continually worried about the patient who might be dying at any moment is going to have to have all of the help that he can possibly get to make certain that the things that he does are being done as efficiently as possible. This will certainly save lives. And how can one do a cost-benefit analysis on a life saved? I am just categorically in favor of having intelligent, motivated, well-trained people in hospitals helping physicians and working for the good of patients.
You've given examples of engineers working in hospitals to provide support for those operations. Just what other opportunities might you see for engineers in the whole field?
The persons have just acquired an EE, ME, or similar engineering degree have been met as they leave with their diplomas by various industries and graduate engineering programs that want people with the training that that kind of a degree implies. Unfortunately, medical schools and hospitals and health centers have not recognized that that kind of training would make good physicians and necessary paramedical personnel. Now that the demands for this kind of training have slackened in industry and universities, the medical profession has a good opportunity, it seems to me, to get people with this kind of training. What is more, it seems to me that there are some areas where engineers would be eminently better suited than we now seem to realize. For example, medical school instructors in academic medicine. If doctors are going to have to take care of patients with computerized monitoring with the electronic equipment, it seems to me there should be some people around in the medical schools right now teaching them how to do it. And I think that we ought to be training some engineers to become academic medical personnel.
And what levels of salary are available now and perhaps in the future for the engineer doing engineering work, for example, in the hospital?
Right now, when the hospitals are not fully aware of the full service that such a group can give, they start at $9,000 a year. Someone with a higher degree who would be willing to take the responsibility for the safety of the hospital can get up to $20,000 a year, and hospitals are looking for such people. But as these groups become self-sustaining, it's very likely that the salaries will be increased.
Thank you, Julia Apter, for giving us your views of this growing field of engineering employment. I know you're very much interested in the role of the woman engineer as well, but that's a subject for another tape. This winds up our story. As usual in Soundings, we've concentrated more on personal opinions and practical experience of our contributors than on the details of the technology involved. For the latter, we suggest that you become familiar, if you're not already, with the IEEE Group on Engineering in Medicine and Biology, and their publication, The Transactions. Thanks are due to Dr. Morton Schwartz and to Mr. Temple W. Newman of Philco Ford, who organized the Westcon sessions from which the presentations you heard were extracted. Thanks also to Howard Fawcett of Cambridge Instrument Company, who recorded our heart sounds. Until next time, your editor, Walt Beam, better make it this time, Dr. W.R. Beam, wishes you the best of health through the finest of engineering.